Some of these we've already heard, so I'm just going to go through them quickly. But I wanted to give you a chance to hear them in Jung's words. And at this point, a lot of it will just be checking out. Is what he just said jive with what you think we're talking about? So on Miss Miller now, about how she goes wrong. Miss Miller is still youthful enough to see her ideal in a man. As an infantile person, Miss Miller cannot realize what her task in life is. She cannot set any goal or standard for which she feels responsible. Therefore, she is not yet prepared to accept the problem of love either, for this demands full consciousness, responsibility, circumspection, and foresight. So she is literalizing the image. She's comparing other men to it, and that's where she's stuck. That's the problem. Jung
doesn't want to go there.
I think he would say when the thing very first started, there was nothing weird about it, but she had nobody to help her understand the meaning, and then it became like a bad habit.
And she chose to get psychotic about it.
Yeah.
Why do you say, though, that she chose that? Because, if she was black, very young in childhood, there was a threat to her of actual death involved with the things she had been repressed. So it seems to me kind of simplistic to just say, grow up and see how it is. When it's so deep, she's got to work through that.
Well, I didn't say grow up and see how it is. And she said, "Joe's." So,
you don't go out to the authority unless there was a real threat seriously to you in infancy or childhood.
And women at the turn of the century were allowed very little ego. And if you're going to be able to have any place container for this energy to come, you have to have a fairly well-developed ego. That's the whole problem. She got a download of energy, and her ego was not large enough to hold it, and it blew her out of the water. And that was not just her problem. That was a problem of all women.
That's what I was trying to say. She didn't have an ego developed.
I agree.
A conscious versus unconscious situation.
She was assaulted.
She probably did choose that, but she had no conscious ability to have that choice.
Well, that's with ego.
Not that, so everybody's right.
Well, Jung would say she didn't have the information.
Because he hadn't written the book yet.
Right.
And
he knew he was headed for that. And he better get it or go belly up.
But I wonder what's complicated some of this too, is that I saw a documentary about a year ago where there are certain brain, you can call them disorders, where they're in a center, there's a disorder, and they have these characteristics of this woman where they see all this bright imagery. And they see that as, like being in touch with God. Mm-hmm. And they get hooked into it. But when they get medicated, they lose that. And they always say, from that documentary, they miss it. So I'm thinking that some people may have a propensity for that. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole range. That may be a complication on top of the fact that...
I just don't know. I think it would depend on how her therapy went, whether they were able to resolve it psychologically or not. I certainly do think that there are physical causes.
But I'm not saying that was the case, but it just shows that we are different in our brain chemistry, which allow some of us to be more accessible to that kind of imagery in a very bright way than others.
Yep, I agree. More of the same, whenever some 449, whenever some great work is to be accomplished, before which a man recoils, doubtful of his strength, his libido streams back to the fountainhood, and that is the dangerous moment when the issue hangs between annihilation and new life. So your energy, in her case, falls back in the unconscious, and an image is generated, and then the question is, are you going to stay stuck with that image, or are you going to be able to disengage from the image and understand its meaning? Fourth, the libido gets stuck in the wonderland of this inner world, that would be getting drunk on the image, then he is already moribund and seriously ill. But if the libido manages to, tear itself loose and force its way up again, something like a miracle happens. That would be if you can begin to interpret the meaning of the image. The journey to the underworld was a plunge into the fountain of youth, and the libido, apparently dead, wakes to renewed fruitfulness. What we've been saying. Is that, everybody okay with that? Okay. another way to say what we've already been saying, the incest tendency is really only the desire of the unconscious to be taken notice of. That makes sense? Unconscious to be taken notice of is that this thing wants to be there, and when it's ready to take a step, your energy will know to go back in, and that will be symbolized by, can be symbolized by incest dreams, feeling that it's not about cohabitation, but rebirth. Just a nice little one-liner. Nothing endangers this connection more in a man than a successful life. It makes him forget his dependence on the unconscious. Another little good one-liner, the demands of the unconscious act at first like a paralyzing poison on a man's energy and resourcefulness, so that it may well be compared to the bite of a poisonous snake. So sometimes this production, this imagery, if it goes against what we think is the direction of our life, can be felt as numbing us or laming us. And one of the frequent images in dreams at this point is a snake wants to bite. And you have to watch, if you're in my shoes, does that person allow the snake to bite them or not? If the person allows the snake to bite them, that would mean they're going to be open to this message from the unconscious, which may run contrary to their own expectation, and really depress them for a while, because they're discombobulated for a time. Again, more of the same. At this stage, the mother symbol no longer connects back to the beginnings, but points towards the unconscious as the creative matrix of the future. So you go back, not to go back, but because there are the seeds for that image, which is going to point you forward. Entry into the mother then means establishing a relationship between the ego and the unconscious. Okay? You're happy or you're quiet? Which? Oh. Okay. Just so you're not confused. Now, a little bit back to Miss Miller, so we're shifting levels. Chiwantabal, playing the role of the author, is not yet wounded or killed. See, the hero in her story doesn't descend. So she is not going to be able to understand the meaning at this point. He is the bold adventurer who dares to do what Miss Miller obviously shrinks from doing. He offers himself of his own free will as a target for the fatal arrow shot. The fact that this gesture of self-exposure is projected upon a masculine figure is direct proof that the dreamer is quite unconscious of its necessity. The animus is not a real man at all for her. Now, the animus would not have been in 1912. He is a slightly hysterical infantile hero whose longing to be loved shows through the gaps in his armor. It is in this garb that Miss Miller has dressed the critical decisions of her life, or rather, these decisions have not yet gone beyond the state of unconscious fantasy and are still not recognized by her conscious mind as her own decisions. So her problem is that this hero is proud, and which means she is proud, and the hero is not going to allow itself to be killed, which means she is not going to allow herself to go inside and see what needs to be learned. Now again, back to being a bit Freudian. The whole of libido is needed for the battle of life. The dreamer cannot bring herself to this decision, which would tear aside all sentimental attachments to childhood, to father and mother, and yet it must be taken if she wishes to follow the call of her individual destiny. So we've said, oh, actually, it's not mother and father, it's the self in the mother and father imagery, but he slips in his old paradigm here. And as you have hopefully recognized, the whole point of this exercise is to gain access to the knowledge in the unconscious of how your life can evolve, which he says in his words, whoever sets foot in this realm, the unconscious, submits his conscious ego personality to the controlling influence of the unconscious. And as I said, that little statement, controlling influence of the unconscious, is an inadequate formulation, and he will spend the rest of his life. Bottom of page 5.
Oh, okay.
Controlling influence of the unconscious. Yes, that's pretty good as a first formulation, but he'll spend the rest of his life refining that statement. Just how does the unconscious affect us, and what do we have to do to get it to affect us properly? So that is the gateway to his later works. But I felt it would be important for you to hear how he got there, so that the works that come after this will be building on this understanding. The unconscious guides us, but how it guides us and our role in making sure that guidance is creative, he has yet to develop. Bella was asking me at the break, well, where does Jung stand about God? And that's a hard question to answer, and I didn't feel I could give a quick, easy answer, but the very last one of these we do will be addressing just that question. But let it be said, at least provisionally, that to answer that question, you have to understand what Jung means by religion, and you have to understand what Jung means by God. I don't think we're quite prepared to do that yet. But this statement is sort of a morsel that you can chew on in the meantime. Page 6 at the top. The onslaught of instinct then becomes an experience of divinity, provided that man does not succumb to it and follow it blindly, but defends his humanity against the animal nature of the divine power. There's a lot in that sentence which probably isn't going to make sense. But what interests Jung is what crosses our path. What is stronger than our willpower? And how that can actually have a beneficial effect on our life. And what the model he is working with is with people of the modern time, and that, to explain that sentence, means understanding his book, Ion. So I do realize I just said something loaded there. But to understand people of the modern time, or if you care, postmodern, certainly not medieval or classical people, but the stuff we're wrestling with. The real stuff that shapes life powerfully, as far as Jung is concerned, is not spiritual. It is instinctual. This is where he owed his debt to Freud. There, he and Freud are in agreement. However, having said that, instinct is not quite so easily said to be just instinctual. There is something divine about instinct. And what is divine about instinct, for our present purposes, let me say, is the ability of instinctual experiences to guide us. If you think about what we've done here, she started out with an instinctual experience. She was either consciously or unconsciously erotically attracted to a man. and what we've been trying to get her to is how there is guidance in that experience to move her forward in life. So the onslaught of instinct would be her experience of that sailor. The experience of divinity would be the non-ego guidance which is available to her within this experience if she knows how to respond to it. Succumbing to it blindly would mean taking that image literally and acting on it rather than holding ground against its power and begin working with it symbolically in the way Jung has tried to lay out throughout this whole book. So this is the beginning of Jung's redefining what he understands religion to be. Really, I would even say what religion needs to be if religion isn't going to kill us in the next couple hundred years. All of this is ahead. Just wanted to give you a taste of that sense. paragraph 511. Something we haven't talked about is the role of the father in all this process. Father images. Once you've got into the unconscious, or in the process of getting into the unconscious, what is the role of the father? Well, very briefly, we've said that the hero is this descent and ascent, which is the same thing as entering into the mother, which is the same thing as incest. And that the fear of the incest can be what can keep you from going into the process. That is one reason you can fear this work. You've talked about his fear of death, and I think that's not incorrect. The other fear Jung felt is the fear of rejection by convention. That if you go into this process and you become yourself, you're no longer accepted by what is, quote, normal, what is in, what is normative. And that would also keep you from going into yourself because you're terrified of becoming different, is if you're different, you'll be more lonely. And that's what he calls the fear of this process from the father being the voice that expresses law and the way things are. That's a detail. Sacrifice, we've sort of talked about, and I've tried to sum that up by saying that this descent into the unconscious can either be destructive or creative. And here's what Jung has to say. Miss Miller's ego is separated by a gulf from the figure of Chewantable. There will never be any possibility of a meeting or union of consciousness and unconscious, the one thing needed to compensate the conscious attitude and create wholeness. The situation holds no favorable prognosis for Miss Miller. In other words, she'll never be able to understand that image. And what that image, he feels, given lack of input from anyone who knows what's going on at this point. What that image represents is a standpoint about who she is, which is in her unconscious. And it's trying to communicate information to her to bring her conscious personality more in line with how the unconscious image wants her to be. In a successful situation, the conscious personality would be able to hear the meaning of that image and make a change. With her, it doesn't happen. That's what he means by a meeting or union of conscious and unconscious. A understanding on the part of consciousness of the meaning of that image, which is generated from within the unconscious. The unconscious takes over the forward striving function, that is to say, it produces that image. The process of transformation in time and breaks the deadlock. The contents then pouring into consciousness are archetypal representations of what the conscious mind should have experienced if deadlock was to be avoided. So we need these images that are appearing to reorient us so we can go forward. all this sound like what you've heard? Good. Now what I was saying about the sacrifice. The instinctive desire, or libido, is given up in order that it may be regained in a new form. So she has to give up literally wanting to be this great poet and hear the meaning of her poetry, hear the meaning of these images. And if she can do that, she'll get the energy that is in that symbol back, but in a new form. A sacrifice to the unconscious, which spontaneously attracts energy from the conscious mind because it has strayed too far from its roots. So the sacrifice is giving up the thought of being a wonderful poet, or literally fulfilling what the desire is. Consciousness gives up its power and possessions in the interest of the unconscious. So hearing the meaning of that image is giving up power and possession. And that's not always so easy to do. Questions? I'll read you one last paragraph and then we can just chat and work through as much as you'd like to discuss. Now, we've heard the argument. Hopefully, you got it. Energy blocked falls into this symbol-creating capacity. Symbol-creating capacity uses many different images to express what it's driving at. What it wants to drive at is the hero. So it creates an image of the hero indirectly through the poem, through the chuatable figure, and through the sun. The meaning of that image is the descent into the unconscious to reorient oneself through the meaning of what the unconscious is producing in images. That is the same as incest, that's going inside oneself. If one can go inside and hear then what the image is asking and surrender to the meaning of the image as opposed to what you are so darn sure it means, you can allow that image to speak to itself, and then you are reoriented through this sort of intrinsic feedback loop and your life can go forward. Several places to get stuck, typically one, not letting the image come up in the first place, or once it does come up, making sure that you get its literal satisfaction, not its metaphorical meaning. If that's the case, you remain fascinated by that image and you're just as bad as when you started. So that's the summary of the book, in a sense. Here's Jung's concluding remarks about what he would have done in therapy. It is hardly to be supposed that Miss Miller, who evidently had not the faintest clue as to the real meaning of her visions, which even Theodore Flournoy, despite his fine feelings for values, could do nothing to explain, would be able to meet the next phase of the process, namely the assimilation of the hero to her conscious personality. That makes sense? To hear the meaning of that image. She has no way to do that without literally hearing what we've heard today in so many words. In order to do so, she would have had to recognize what fate demanded of her and what was the meaning of the bizarre images that had broken in upon her consciousness. The instinctual impulse that was trying to rouse the dreamer was opposed by a personal pride that was distinctly out of place. That would be the arrogance of Chuantepo. And also by a correspondingly narrow moral horizon, so that there was nothing to help her understand the spiritual content of the symbols. Had I treated Miss Miller, I would have had to tell her some of the things of which I have written in this book in order to build up her conscious mind to the point where it could have understood the contents of the collective unconscious.
This might be a question, but what do you
mean
between images and symbols?
Between images and what?
And symbols. Well, images are symbols. Another way to put that is Jung says images, the figures in your dreams, are symbols, meaning pointing to the future. Where Freud's position is they are symptoms holding patterns of the past. So whether it's a symptom or a symbol, really depends on how you understand it. having, though, realizing that Jung does feel under certain circumstances, images can be symptoms.
Talking about that she has to assimilate the hero into her current conscious personality. Could you give us like an example of what kinds of things she might actually have had to do, given the what pieces of information we have about her?
Well, we don't really know. The immediate message, I think, behind the fact that it is a hero image, is that she needs to go through a death and rebirth. That she needs to go inside and begin to hear the meaning of what comes up. Now, what is it that those images will be telling her past that she needs to go inside? We don't know. Probably questions about her emotional honesty. I'm guessing about her future professional career. Perhaps about her relationship to her family.
So she's got to look at reality and not run from it.
Is that basically? Yes, or look at the point of view of her unconscious on the various facets of her reality.
Okay.
Professionally, personally, socially, sexually, family.
Could she have chosen somebody like this Aztec Indian that was so different from her for the purpose of putting something in her dreams that was totally out of her reach?
Yes.
Because she was afraid to be open about her own sexuality.
Well, we don't...
Could she have picked something so far away so she wouldn't have to?
That's the reductive point of view. See what I'm saying?
That'd be the Freudian one?
Yeah. Which Jung is saying, I don't know, that could be the case. He's not able to give us a clear picture of what her situation is. But what he is using is her text to give examples and then to us understand it might be that way, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way.
See, then I don't understand how now what would Jung have said her reason for choosing that character?
Choosing Chewantopol?
That type of character.
Either what you said, that could be a possibility. Or, I would say, because it is so unrealistic, that because the images move further away from reality, it's driving home to her that it is not to be physically, literally true. That it's a fantastic image to show that this is to be understood on a symbolic level. That's what I would say.
Could it be also what you were saying is that the images couldn't have been to pull everything? Could it be going on in the mind?
Here we don't see it yet.
Oh, yeah?
No. But what we're going to see is that image that comes up in the subsequent... Jung's subsequent investigation is not a single image, but two images. Not a unity, but a polarity.
I was going to ask you also, in terms of the sacrifice, what you see through history is that cultures, at least religious, maybe it's going to get too much into religion, they use sacrifices in their religious rituals. Does this at all relate to what Jung is dealing with?
Yes.
It's kind of like a substitute for the individual going through the sacrifice and having an animal. Or in Christianity, you talk about Christ being the sacrificial lamb.
This is a very good question. The Jung certainly feels that one of the key features of the analytic process, when it's successful, is that a sacrifice is required. Now, as soon as you hear that word, your anti-Christian feelings are probably going to go whoop! Because what Christianity means by sacrifice and what Jung means by sacrifice aren't the same. What Christianity means by sacrifice is you have to sacrifice the instinct for the spirit. Give up that desire. What Jung is saying, you have to sacrifice the spirit for the instinct. The sacrifice is having the humility to accept the instinctual experience, live with it, not go to its, not go away from it to any spirituality, but live with that instinct until it speaks to you.
What about the more elementary cultures who have used animals? What is involved in there?
I think, and this will be what we get to when we get to Ion, I guess it'll be the first one next, let me do it with my list, first one next fall. First one next fall. We are at a period of history that has never existed before. And up to now, the concept of sacrifice has rightly always been understood as the sacrifice of the animal.
Of the what?
Animal. The inner animal. Passion, desire.
Inner animal.
Yeah.
When the actual animal was sacrificed.
It was a projection.
Oh, okay.
So, Jung is not disputing that was necessary up to now, but for reasons that will get us too far astray, believe me, we'll get into it. You might really want to keep listing some of your questions. These are good questions. I don't want to give you too much to get indigestion at one time, but that this moment of history, and I do think it's why it's exciting to be alive, and it's why I think Jungian psychology offer something nobody else does. A fundamental shift is occurring where what we understand by sacrifice must change. And now it is no longer the animal that is sacrificed for the spirit, but the spirit is sacrificed and the animal has to live. So actually what it does, it flips everything upside down. What has traditionally been called sin becomes the desirable end, and what has traditionally been called salvation becomes the sin. In a sense, you can see what I'm talking about. Let's suppose Miss Miller were married and she had this fantasy of the sailor. I would not say to her, if I were a therapist, oh, get rid of that feeling. I would say, let's see what that feeling is asking of you. What that feeling may be asking of her is to have an affair with that guy. So I am actually supporting her movement away from the cultural commandment of our time. I'm asking her to be an adulteress. And I have done that. And it's amazing to watch what the unconscious does with it. The unconscious leads you into what has traditionally been called sin. But it's don't get excited. Because it's not as what you think. And I always have to tell people what Bob Dylan said, if you want to break the law, you have to be honest. This is not about becoming immoral. It's about finding a higher level of morality. But true, what has traditionally been forbidden must be accepted, and I think that is the sacrifice of our feeling of respectability, our sacrifice of feeling pure, our sacrifice of feeling better than other people, our sacrifice of being this evolved society, this evolved individual, this paragon of virtue in the neighborhood. That's what has to be sacrificed. And you see, that's what Jung sacrificed. Clearly so. It doesn't mean you can just go be a criminal. It means another set of principles come in. This process starts to guide you, and it may at times ask you to break the law, the moral law. But you have to do so devoted to the process, which is a higher sort of devotion.
I don't know that that's anything that's especially new. I mean, it seems like in the Old Testament, certainly King David was the point of example. God didn't have any problem.
But he doesn't become conscious through it. That's the difference, I think.
David doesn't?
I don't think so. If he became conscious through it, he'd stop listening to what that guy said. I felt I had to explain that because when you hear the word sacrifice, you hear, oh God, I have to give that up now. And no, that's not what Jung is saying. It's not a sacrifice of the bad for the good, but a reevaluation of what is good and bad. But you won't like whatever it is you have to do.
You know? Otherwise, it wouldn't be a sacrifice.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be a sacrifice, you know. But you do it, and you lose your respectability. You whatever it is, you have to pay something. Emotionally. We have time, so it's over to you guys now. Whatever you want to talk about.
You have to be pretty clear. I mean, when you talk about sacrifice, you have to be pretty clear about what you're being asked, you do, because you can lose an awful lot by making the wrong choice, interpreting things wrong, making the wrong choice.
Yes.
You can lose by the right choice, too.
But isn't that talking about that being conscious of what you did, and if you're if we're going to a place we've never been before, we have no knowledge of it,
mm-hmm.
consciousness
of that. And to follow your desires, certainly in my experience, there's this desire, and the way you tell good desire is that thing that's been in me all of my life that I've always said no to, and it never goes away. And it's like I'm now faced with, you know, am I going to go to my death having always put that aside, or am I going to give up the thing that I had chosen instead of it, which was, you know, safety or whatever.
Yeah.
And the terror there is just so intense, but it's finally like, you know, if I don't, it'll be worse than death. So there's something in you that has been talking to you for a very long time. It's not, you know, if you've paid any attention at all, it's not a mystery.
That's what I think you took over. I don't know how much you want to believe, but whatever happens in life, if you can have some clues for what you can go inside or what dreams you are having.
Yeah.
So that can be some clues.
Of course, this is why we use dreams.
Yeah, because something is not working, or at some point you're not happy or something, that triggers also some things to think, okay, maybe I'm doing that change, but I'm doing something about it.
I'm still confused by it. You know, spirit must be sacrificed, and it seems to me that you're saying conventions must be sacrificed.
Yes.
And spirituality for me is the relationship with the mystery, whatever the mystery is. The mystery might very well be the instinct for that matter.
Yeah. Well, then you're already there.
Well, but see, that's the old. That's not a new concept. I mean, that's kind of real. A long time. You go back to Meister Eckhart and some of the...
Yeah, and how did the church embrace them?
Well, I'm not saying that. I think that most of organized church is really about the conventions, I'm Catholic, for better or for worse, I'm kind of Catholic. I still work for the church, but kind of moving to where Nancy Parsons moved. But actually, we've already moved there, but I can say that I'm still working with the place, so I've got to make a list. But,
well, I don't disagree that there are examples of what you're talking about, but I think where we are now is a fundamental shift in the larger sense. There was Eckhart, yeah. There was Teilhard de Chardin. His works were silenced, you know. There are points of light, but the general attitude now is being assaulted with the need for a change.
Okay. don't know that I disagree with that, but I also think that that's, I mean, vastly people on those episodes were, you know, there was a really fundamental shift. And what's happening now is that there's a reaction to that shift, but the door's been open, and it's coming, it's going to happen. Things are not what they used to be. The conventions of the religion are not going to be able to contain it.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, that sets up that the whole tension of opposites. I mean, which he does mention in here, even though he probably added that later in 51. Obviously, 1912, he was just starting to read the alchemical stuff. But the notion of holding the tension of the opposites without getting one way or the other, an image will be presented, which then provides the guidance that one is seeking to try to navigate these difficult waters. This gets into the point when you were talking about telling people, you know, go to have an affair and stuff like that. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean to break your vows and go out and do this stuff. It means to just the consideration of that and then putting that against what your morality says. Well, I can't do that. I'm a married man, you know, and then all of a sudden that creates a tension. Out of that tension situation comes an image, and then the image will give you some guidance. That seems to be
interesting. One of the pieces, if you look at what's known as the internal form in the Catholic Church, it's something that's been in the rule books forever. It's never really talked about much. Most people don't know, you know, wouldn't know what it is. But when it comes right down to it, if a person understands the conventions, the law, and a person feels called or compelled or driven instinctually to do something different, and you understand what the law is, you've really done your work, you've really tried to understand, and you still feel like you're compelled to do something that's contrary to it, the church says you're obligated to call your conscience. You're obligated to follow the compelling force. That's been part of teaching forever.
So is that why you have such problems with pedophilia in the Catholic Church?
That's the reason why we have problems with pedophilia. I'm not sure I'm getting the question right.
Well, if they're to follow their conscience and they're told, you know, their conscience tells them, I want to rub this little boy's bottom or something, you know, they follow that through, then by what you just said, the church says, hey, that's cool.
Could be that. I mean, if that was all that was going on there, I mean, if there wasn't some of the reduction stuff going on, there's something else that had an influence in that. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, that's, you know, is that where one's instinct might lead oneself?
But I think it's important to know that all of this stuff has been around forever. I mean, the myths go back thousands and thousands of years, and all of these images are in the myth. But we're talking about just because it was there doesn't mean that it resides in the collective consciousness. And what Gary, I think you're saying is that the pieces that are meant to be alive and operating in the collective consciousness need to be reshuffled. And they're going to be coming from those things that were there before. Now, some things are maybe coming that have never been before, but a lot of it's already been in there, but it never floated to the surface on a large scale.
Okay.
It's a large scale, yeah. And, you know, to be honest with you, if you really want to talk about the church, I've never seen a priest who could face himself, ever, in my work.
Priest?
I've never seen a priest who could face themselves in my work. As soon as sex comes out, they're out the door. And that's sad.
Yeah. Well, I didn't join the club because of that.
You mean if they stayed in the church? Because I know one and you left the church.
Yeah. And some of these are some very fine guys who really, really, if the church would wake up, would be the leaders of the future. But as soon as... some of you heard this. I mean, this is just classic. I saw one guy. He dreamt that he was to witness the resurrection of Christ. And Christ was brought in the casket, the lid opened. Christ alone. And Christ was a woman.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted to make love.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran.
Mm-hmm.
Terminated the next week. They just can't do it. The conflict is impossible. I feel sorry for him.
Well, part of that is the power of the whole system.
Yeah.
I mean, not just them, too, it's the whole system. Some are.
Oh, yeah, I feel they're victims.
They're somewhere.
And as I say, these are really decent, I mean, these are guys who were very decent people. Yeah.
So without getting off at Roman Catholic Church, because I have a history there too, that we don't just see it there. Right before the election, Ted Hagar came out, and he did the evangelical movement. And, you know, certainly he could get in national television and lie to people.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, he knew that what was going on. And so, you know, this whole repression exists within the paradigm of the old salvation.
Yeah, that's exactly what Una's talking about. How do we transform that?
And I think, you know, Shakespeare, because he thinks that does pretend
too much. Mm-hmm.
And
so
when you get to this radical 180 degrees, which we've kind of come to with a lot of movements, then you've got to go the opposite, which is, of course, the sin.
I mean,
you have to choose that.
Right.
But
you would find
sometimes
that
you do.
Would be
lovely.
Sometimes you do.
And one of the problems that I was reading that ministers in general get in trouble is that the congregation itself wants to put them on a pedestal,
mm-hmm.
and they sometimes get on that pedestal,
mm-hmm.
and then they lose track of mm-hmm. what you were talking about, or the fear
earth,
of ground.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then they lose the balance.
Well, the other part of it is that we've got a monotheism that has a unitary God that is masculine, and divinity is a married couple, and just like you said, in the sex, Christ rose and it was feminine, and she wanted to make love. So it's like the goddess is back. Divinity is pulling into this sense of the pair, the cooperative pair, and anything based on the past is not gonna exist. And in all the things they call it disruptive technology, just like the IBM PC, that did not happen inside of IBM. It was a whole new company that literally moved from New York down to Florida, and the new thing came from the new place. Just like Lutheranism was not something that happened inside the Catholic Church. So the new thing is not going to happen inside the existing containers. It's going to happen, well, just like Horus. He's born outside, so that new thing is born outside into its own container, and then life flows into that.
Anything else? Any other points you want to focus on? Don't be shy. Well, sometimes people don't understand points in the discussion, and I think, well, everyone else seems to. I don't, but I just want you to feel free to.
I had one question.
Yeah.
We were talking about it at lunch, and that was, what is the, how did this imagery come to, what's her name, Miss
Miller?
Yeah. Is that unusual for her, for a person to get a fully enclosed poem like that?
I don't think so, no.
And unusual. So, I mean, was that some kind of, it wasn't a dream, right?
Well, she called it hypnagogic images. So as she was going to sleep or waking up, she'd see and hear images fluttering before her eyes, so to speak.
Is that kind of like guided imagery?
No. Haven't you ever, I don't know, just sort of in a reverie, just before you go to sleep or just when you wake up, have something in the surface of your consciousness in terms of a story or a dream? You're kind of half awake, half asleep. That's what she was doing.
I think, too, you discussed with a little bit about how getting the different images sometimes becomes an act of imagination compared with
this is passive.
Passive.
Yeah. She just saw them in her mind's eye as she went to sleep or woke up.
And you get a complete poem like that.
Well, what I gave you was her having worked it through.
Oh.
She got it in a kind of a rough form, and Jung goes through all those different stages, but I just tried to give you the final one.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't quite as fixed as this.
I just wondered what Jung, how he conceives the relationships that one has with other people. the importance of that in being able to reveal who oneself really is. Oneself or one's direction or one's instinct, whatever words are used. But when I think about this, is the self-psychological object relation stuff where the baby's born, the baby knows who baby is from the way mother looks at baby. And how, in a sense, in the therapy process, that can probably happen. You don't necessarily, it isn't just going back to a past point in history to try to be a different mommy or daddy than the first has, but that right now, in the moment that you have with the person, there's some of that going on, where the person is seeing who they are through the eyes of the person that's looking at them.
I think for Jung, this is discussed under the term of projection. That, does everyone follow the question? Okay, this is a little bit object relations versus Jung. You say the person is seeing their eyes through the other. I say the person is seeing themselves through what they think is the eyes of the other. That's the big difference. And what they think is the eyes of the other is their own perception of themselves, externalized. Yes, from there I think we would agree that the job in any relationship, certainly in therapy, is that you're constantly clarifying, are you seeing me or am I seeing you seeing me? That is a big difference. So we don't, you see, Jung places so little emphasis on this compared to what is done in Freudian neo-psychology, or neo-Freudian psychology, because he doesn't feel that these perceptions are free of projection, and the important thing is what the projection is.
Yeah.
So the individual in therapy has been projecting parts of themselves onto the analyst, who is just really serving as a mirror for that. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And also for the same thing,
having
perfect benefit. Yeah. Definitely. Which is not to say this is all relationship is, but it's part of it.
Where does empathy come in? Is empathy a rejection?
Yes.
Can empathy just be?
Yes.
Not projecting?
Yes.
Because I was thinking that if you project onto someone, to me it's about being empathy. If you're just standing with the person, maybe it's just my definition.
Well, no, I mean, this is a subtle issue, and it really does define a huge difference between us Jungians and other schools of psychology. If I empathize with somebody, why is that effective? Because I, in our view, I am playing for them their own capacity of understanding themselves. So that's what I mean by it being a projection. And at times I think that is very important. I think at times it is important not to do that, but to create the situation where they have to begin empathizing with themselves. See, this process presupposes that the subject and object are different, but when I empathize, I become like you. And that is certainly important, but there are times when it's important not to do that. In our view, the healing thing isn't the empathy. It's the authenticity of the therapist. And that, as we're going to see, this becomes two. That becomes a self. And the important thing in therapy is that that self knows that the person it's talking to has got a real self. And this is where the healing goes on. Jung, I guess, could say a most outrageous thing to people. And it worked. Because his self and their self were in connection. That's what we're attempting to understand. So that my selfhood supports this process for them. And it doesn't have to be empathetic. It can be actually quite the contrary.
Contentious
can be. And how do you know? Well, that's what makes you or breaks you in my field. Either you know that or you don't know that. Not to say one always gets it right, but it's a feeling. Anything else? Well, I think we can stop. Thanks for hanging in there. Mm-hmm.